Okay, today I have, today there's a little more baggage, we say in English, with our topic than what we've had in the two previous lessons. And so I've got some preliminary remarks to help, as it were, fill in. This is not sort of a tabula rasa in the sense that there are other people who have approached this subject. And the subject also is one that is connected to a discussion that is, I would qualify, a difficult discussion within the context of chemited studies. And this is the what many have called the, or what one can call the Zoroastrian question, because these structures that we'll be looking at today have often been invoked in discussions of the nature of Achaemenid religion in the Achaemenid period. I want to stress that I am not going to offer an answer to the question as to the religious inclinations of the Achaemenids at the time of Darius. This material that we're going to look at is part of a much larger dossier of both textual and visual material that is still in process of compilation and, of course, lacks still a synthesis. Now, every year there are many publications on the issue of the religion at the time of early Achaemenid, at the time of the early Achaemenids. And I don't have time to go through all of that, but I do want to point out a very important publication from my perspective, which is Walter Hinckelmann's book, The Other Gods Who Are, if only because it essentially deals with the textual, in one way, just deals with the textual aspect of some of the questions that we'll be looking at from a visual perspective today. And I'll come back and touch on that just a little bit more. I think it's a valid question to say, why even ought we to look at these things? Why are these things important? And what I would like to do now is sort of redirect this issue to why some other contexts in which we might think about this material. I do not think it's our job to try to assign labels or categories, as it were, to these images, but to try to place them in broader context. And I stress the plural here because there are multiple contexts in which we ought to think about this this material. And as I mentioned, before we can begin to, I think, really understand the religious landscape at Persepolis in the late 6th century, we need to do a lot more work of synthesis on these various textual and visual data that we have. So in some ways, we're interested in a very, very narrow aspect of much broader research questions. Now, one of the contexts that I'm very, that I think is very important in which we ought to situate these images from Persepolis is in the broader context of the discussions of the dynamics of empire. And here, this again is another research question that sees many publications each year. And there have been many studies that have attempted to sort of think about this dynamic of empire as part of a larger question of cultural transformations that are taking place with various ideological, political, and religious issues that are playing a role there. And of course, many of you will be aware that this whole question of religion was foregrounded in a work by Jaspers where he posited this idea of the axial ages. Now, first of all, I'm not going to go into that, and it's, of course, there's a lot of difficulties with this whole concept. I mention it only as, again, part of a historiographic tradition in which we might think about. What that work has done, however, is it stressed how important these sorts of changes are in the developmental trajectory of social and political elites, and how these, what we could call, I guess, psycho-ideological systems underpin political and social power. So in that sense, I think it's a very helpful, as it were, paradigm. Others, such as Mann, have really brought to light how these, I guess you could call them transcendental religions, have played a role in the sort of dynamics of the cultures which they've dominated. And in particular, ideas that I think are very helpful, the control of resources, that is both ideological and material resources, the articulation of structures of power, and the formation of elite identities. And here again, the Persepolis material is exceptionally strong, and I tried to touch a little bit on this in our discussion of Zsigmond and the formation of elite identities. All of this work, I think, ultimately tracks back to Marx, who of course saw religion as a form of ideological power, a way to express political structures, and an instrument of domination. And much recent research has underlined the importance, from the perspective of empire, of having an elite that is integrated into the system, right? That is essentially has bought into the system. And again, that was something that we talked a little bit about last week. That is, an elite, such as Zsigmond and these other officials, who have their own base of power and resources, and they have an identity, right, and that is a rooted identity that is ideologically legitimate. One other way that I think is helpful in thinking about this material is the idea that the state is the place of interface, right, where things meet for these sort of practical state institutions and religion. So, of course, in the ancient Near East, concepts of kingship were acutely aware of the need for these sorts of ideological manipulation in order to root and provide a base of support for power and legitimacy. Again, I stress, we're looking today at only one very small aspect of an issue that's embedded in these larger types of questions. Nongshi Rustam obviously is going to play a critical part, or has played a critical part in this discussion. What I'd like to do now very briefly is turn and let's look a little more specifically at this idea of religion and empire in Fars. From my perspective, this is a very difficult, or it has been a very difficult issue to tackle within the early Achaemenid context. The reasons for this are traced back already with the decipherment of the royal inscriptions, and all commentators almost to me seem to be forced to have to sort of deal with this very narrow question as to whether or not the Achaemenid kings and the Iranians more general in the late 6th century were Zoroastrian. Of course, there are two elements in these royal inscriptions, especially at Bisitun and Nongshi Rustam, which have formed the base of this type of inquiry. The repeated invocation of the god Ahura Mazda. This is true also of other inscriptions at Persepolis and Susa. And the dichotomy that is sometimes established between the truth and the lie. Now, again, I know many of you know this, but it may just be worth, again, to get us rolling here, that Ahura Mazda is the Avestan name of the primary god of Zoroastrianism. The Avesta itself, of course, refers to these texts that are written in this characteristic language that we call Avestan, part of a subgroup of Indo-Iranian, to essentially write these sacred texts. We know that Zoroastrianism played a critical role in the Sasanian period, and here's where the difficulty comes. The texts, of course, all date much, much later than the Sasanian period. Nonetheless, there is this remarkably strong desire to identify Ahura Mazda in the royal inscriptions with the principal god of Zoroastrianism. Now, Pierre has addressed this quite eloquently in his book. He calls it the pseudo-question of Zoroastrianism and mentions that it's consumed enormous energy. And again, he has suggested that we try to displace this scholarly energy to one where we think about the religious component of monarchic ideology of the Achaemenids, which, of course, is placing it within these larger contexts of the dynamics of empire. I hopefully will do that as well. Now, again, there have been many researchers who have attempted to integrate this material in a kind of a larger discussion, for instance, of legitimacy of power, of royal power. But they tend to frame those questions within a Zoroastrian perspective, especially Lincoln and Ahn and Herrenschmidt are examples of that. Now, regardless of your point of view, that is, how one sort of tackles this question, the visual evidence has played a critical role in these discussions, but I would emphasize without really thinking critically about the visual evidence. That is, people will pick and choose various little pieces of visual evidence that seem sympathetic to the points of view that they are attempting to articulate. Now, of course, in the visual evidence, there are basically three things that have played a critical role in these discussions: the so-called figure in the winged disc, and again, I'll have a little bit more to say about that figure in our last lecture. The depiction of religious officials, we'll see some of that a little bit later here on our discussion, and then the so-called altars of fire here at Nongqi Rustam. Now, the importance of the glyptic material from Persepolis is multiform, and that is that it has various layers of importance, and it really distinguishes it by the fact that it has what I call this value-added aspect to it, owing to its archival context. That is, these images that we're going to be looking at today date to a particular period, which happens to be the most formative period of the whole of the Achaemenid Empire. This evidence comes from a particular place, Persepolis. So these parameters thus give us the advantage, right, of dealing only with evidence that has a known and excavated provenance. And I must stress that in most previous discussions, this has not been the case, because oftentimes we're using material, certainly not Nongqi Rustam, but say other seals, that have no provenance. We don't know the date of them as well. So you have no anchor. You're sort of just floating in time and space. We're not floating in time and space with this material because we have a particular place and we have a particular time. And as I've mentioned, this is incredibly important period where all the major protocols, visual and textual protocols, are being established at this time. Now, another part of the sort of the baggage that we have to deal with is simply the term fire altar, which almost everyone agrees is a really bad term. But nonetheless, we continue to use it. Now, the majority of people who use the term fire altar, in fact, are talking about a structure that supports a sacred fire. So that in a strict sense, this would not be an altar. It would be something else. So this is an imprecise term that often is used. That is, if you look at a definition of an altar, it's some kind of structure, right, that has a flat top, and then you place sacrifices. That's the traditional accepted definition of what an altar is. Now, Boyce, to her credit, recognized this and suggested the use of the term fire holder, which I thought was actually a really good way to approach it. But the term has never caught on, and we still refer to these things as fire altars. But be that as it may, whether you call it a fire holder or an altar of fire, The majority of researchers suppose that this shows a cult of fire, and in particular it shows a Zoroastrian cult of fire. We're going to end with Nongshi Rustam, but we'll continue to engage with it periodically as we look at this material. Here, for instance, is one way that an image, in this case the relief of Darius at Nongshi Rustam, has been used. It's a famous and oft-quoted passage from Boyce's influential book on the history of Zoroastrianism. I won't read the whole thing to you. I've highlighted some things here. She then goes on to say that these figures who stand on the sides, three here and three over here, represent the six Ameshaspentas who are meant to reflect the six who are standing around Ahura Mazda. She goes on to say then that the Zoroastrian implications of this tomb sculpture are made explicit by the fact that the king stands before what she calls a fire holder. This is the earliest representation known of the fire holder that will become, in her mind, one of the definitive signs of Zoroastrianism through the ages. And then she goes on to say that one can suppose that to pray before a fire placed on such a support is a rite belonging really to a proper Zoroastrian king. And thus, Darius is making a strong visual affirmation of his belief. Well, you can see the problem that we have encountered here. We have an object. Based on our suppositions, we call it a fire altar because we think it is a Zoroastrian. Then we use that evidence to support our suppositions that there is Zoroastrianism. In other words, this is a vicious circle of self-reference in which we are in which we're involved. So we have to just clear out the terminology. I think the terminology is a stumbling block for us. So for at least to begin, I'll just use what I think is a neutral term structure if there is not a fire indicated, and this is going to be in fact a critical aspect of our discussion today, and then a structure of fire if a fire is indicated on it. And then we'll develop this just a little bit more as we look at the at this material. And as I say, this material has been often used to support various kinds of ideas about fire temples and Zoroastrianism in the early Achaemenid period. But interestingly enough, there are very few places that you can go to get a critical examination of the visual evidence for this. In other words, again, we're just kind of picking and choosing things here and there. Glyptic representations of these structures are the most numerous, and thus they have figured prominently in these various discussions on Achaemenid religion. Again, I don't have time to go through all of them, but I did want to highlight a couple of them that are important. Mori wrote a very short but important article on this issue of fire altars. And as many of his articles, it's really very short, a few pages, but it's exceptionally dense with information. And what he stated, which I think is still pretty much held as an important aspect of these types of scenes, he felt that this scene of a person standing before an altar was really quite original. In other words, he saw it as something distinctively Iranian or perhaps even Achaemenid in its origins. Now, he identified two types of altars, and I will call them, the first one here is the stepped structure. So I'll try not to use the term altar, but we'll just call it the step structure, where you've got these three steps here, and then there's a fire on top of it. And then this other structure that's tall and rectangular that we'll call the tower structure. Now, for Mori, the step structure was Iranian in origin, and the tower structure was Assyrian in origin. In this very same year, Yamamoto published the first part of a two-part study on the Zoroastrian temple cult of fire. And again, he basically identified the same two types of fire structures, although he had a third one, but that was based really on a misreading of one of the treasury seals. He interpreted, Yamamoto interpreted the steppe structure as an Assyrian heritage. Note how Mori saw it as an Iranian one. And then he also did discuss these three seals from the Treasury archive. We'll talk a little bit more about them. And he identified a specific type of sacrifice that was being offered, an offering of animal fat here. Of course, again, his study was geared towards this idea of a Zoroastrian temple cult of fire. And he identified the fire in these scenes as a dynastic fire. That, again, is based on evidence from later periods. I won't really go into it. And I've mentioned to you that, of course, Boyce has approached this material a little bit. She also identified these two types, the stepped and the tower. Interestingly, she was mainly concerned not to talk about them, but to talk about, to try to explain away the things that she saw, that she thought was non-Zoroastrian in the scenes. And then lastly, Hukamp actually provided a catalog of these structures. And again, he identified two of them, the tower and the stepped. And he thought that the stepped structure held a sacred fire for devotion. But what was really more interesting was his discussion of these so-called tower structures, which he thought had a particular relationship with royalty, and he identified as a symbol of royal power and its divine origin. I think these observations are interesting and may play out a little bit in the evidence that we'll look at here today. These, again, unproven on seals that both Mori and Hukamp and Yamamoto discussed as well. Now, Hukamp listed a total of 16 seals in his study that showed this fire structure. That is 16 from all over the empire for its full time span. Of course, a problem is that only five of those 16 had any kind of archaeological provenance and could be dated, and that is the five from the Treasury archive. In the fortification archive alone, as of today, we have 28 seals that show this fire structure in some sort of form. And so if we add then the five from the Treasury archive, we're now looking at a corpus of 33 seals. That is, we've essentially doubled the evidence that Hukamp had at his disposal in 1991. And of course, all of this evidence from Persepolis has a context in time and space, which we could not say. So in other words, here is one way that the glyptic material from Persepolis can contribute to myriad discussions of Achaemenid iconography, simply by doubling, tripling the number of examples that we have traditionally had in thinking about these things. You probably don't want me to, and I will not go over all these myriad of abbreviations that you'll see here, but just remember PFS indicates a seal on an Elamite tablet, PFATS a seal on an Aramaic tablet, and PFUTS a seal on an uninscribed tablet, and in PTS a seal on the Treasury. Okay, yeah, I won't say any more about those. All right, here's what I propose. I will try to organize the evidence from Persepolis, and I won't look at all 33. I'll just bring some selective examples. Based upon, syntax and iconography. That is, we'll start with the stepped structure and look at the types of scenes in which it occurs. So here we'll start first with a type where a figure is seated and seems to be facing this stepped structure. This is seal 94. There appears, of course, to be another attendant over here as well. This seal, in fact, may help us better understand this really strange seal that was found, I believe, in the Treasury. In other words, this is not from the archive, but it's one of the seals that was actually found at Persepolis. I think we have the same sort of scene here, a seated figure. And this is kind of a weird scene no matter what way you look at it. Then we have a group of scenes that show the stepped structure where there is a person who seems to be engaged with the fire in some way. Now, this seal 20 from the Treasury Archive is very often invoked in these discussions. It's a remarkable seal. It's never been drawn, so this is the first drawing that has ever been made of it. I did this only off the tablets that are today in Chicago. It is a remarkably detailed design in showing the table with the mortar and the pestle, the burning fire, the attendant who's poking at it here, these three things that this fellow is holding, and a staff. We have a scene that looks very similar to it, although not as detailed, from Persepolis and Seal 790. And here's another one from the uninscribed tablets, a little more unusual, but an attendant here who is reaching in, perhaps holding some kind of object. This is a kind of a variation of a local carving style that we see there. And then there are these very interesting seals, three of them. There may be as many as five of these. They're all on stamp seals, and they show exactly the same scene. And I mean exactly, like down to the most minute aspects of iconography. Here are three of them here. Let me pull up a detail so you can see a little bit better. This is PFS 578. There's always a stepped structure with a burning fire on it. The attendant stands here, holds what looks to be some sort of vessel, and then something else that is directly over the fire. There's this combed thing over here and this hooked device over here. Here's another one, just flipped, right? But it shows exactly the same thing. Now, in this impression, I originally thought that this thing was some kind of big vessel, like a big goblet or cup, but there is an impression that seems to show lines here like this. But in any case, this might need a little more study to clarify that. Then we have scenes that show this sep structure appear to be scenes of animal butchery. This a remarkable scene here where an animal has been killed and this fellow is in the process of cutting it up. This is probably the same scene. This is, I think, a person's hand with a knife. As you can see, the seal is not very well preserved on this particular tablet. All right, so what are the salient characteristics of these scenes that we've just looked at here? Well, one, a fire is always clearly indicated. In fact, seems to be a critical aspect of the whole thing. The scenes show action. There's almost always a person engaged in some way with the fire. And the attendants are oftentimes holding things, certainly vessels, maybe also sometimes long, narrow objects, perhaps we could call them bundles. And as we've seen, there are implications of butchery of animal and perhaps animal sacrifice as well. Thus, I would say that that these scenes appear to have a high narrative content. That is, there seems to be this kind of action narrative aspect to it, and thus rooted in a reality. Let's turn now to some examples of the other type of structure, the so-called tower structure, which in many ways are more complicated than these step structures. There's a small group that may show the tower structure with one attendant next to it. This is one of the seals from the treasure archive. There may be another attendant over here. These are now only in Tehran, so I've never seen them, so I don't know whether or not there's only one or two. This is one that we've recently found. I haven't drawn it yet, but you see it's quite an elaborate structure, and there appears to be an attendant next to it. Then we have these that we've seen a lot of, where there are two attendants to either side of the step structure. These are ones from the Treasury Archive. And then, of course, we spoke in some detail about Seal 11, the Seal of Zhishawish. And I mentioned also this seal from the uninscribed tablets, which in fact is in and of itself a very remarkable seal, quite detailed in its representation of this structure, the attendants to either side, and the Aramaic inscription, not rendered in the court style. It's a local style of carving, but nonetheless obviously has a lot of royal content. Then we have a very interesting collection of scenes that show this tower altar as a part of a procession. Here is one where we have an attendant holding a vessel. This must be some rendering of that tower structure. This is probably an animal leg over here. And then look at this. I have to tell you, I spend most of my life looking at lumps of clay that are hardly legible. And most of this activity is pretty hard drudgery work to squeeze out these images from these little lumps of clay. And then all of a sudden, you find something like this, and it's unbelievable. On so many levels, it is unbelievable. I only found this seal over the summer, and I haven't really had time to digest everything on it. But it is clearly a remarkable design in showing, we have an attendant who is holding something. Now, on this impression, if you look here, this appears that it may be a duck-headed bow on this part. Over here, it seems less so. But I'm hard-pressed to explain what this object is other than a bow. If it is a bow, then that in and of itself is a remarkably interesting thing that perhaps we ought to talk about next week a little bit more. Note that this person here wears the Assyrian garment. This is not in the core outfit. And then there is a figure who stands on the back of this horned lion creature with a bird's tail. I mean, we cannot help but read this as either a statue of a god or the epiphany of a deity. This, in fact, is the traditional manner which these things are rendered in ancient Western Asia. This, I think, is some form of that tower structure. And then we have the winged symbol above it. I don't know what these things are here, just a remarkable design that, in some ways, just turns upside down all of our previous assumptions about the nature of at least the iconography of religious imagery in Iran at this particular time. Here are a couple of other of these procession ones, leading an animal with the structure. A really complicated scene here. This, I think, must be some version of that tower structure. Here's the half figure attendant, an animal, and another attendant who, again, like that previous seal, appears to be holding something, bringing something in a procession almost as an offering. And I didn't bring this in, but I wanted to. You know those very famous Uruk period seals where there are these attendants who are in a procession leading towards a building. I mean, to me, it's remarkably evocative of that kind of thing. I'm not trying to say that these are based on Uruk period seals, just they're, I think, very evocative. All right, these tower structure scenes, I think, very clearly fall into two types. The first is this type here, which have the attendants on either side of it, one or two. So the salient characteristics are that a fire is never shown. I mean, never is a fire indicated on these structures. These scenes are always calm, static. There's no movement in them at all. The individuals never are engaged with the structure in any kind of intimate way, such as we saw with the step structures. And the individuals always hold flowers or bundles or staffs or something like that. And as I've mentioned, these scenes almost always have high ideological content, that is, Achaemenid royal ideological content, that is, winged symbols, court robes, crowns, date palms, etc. Thus, these scenes, I would say, as we move towards away from the syntax and vocabulary to the semantics, these scenes are strongly emblematic and thus seem rooted to me in the kind of unreal. And we talked a little bit about that with Zishawas's seal last time. On the other hand, there's this other group that show the tower structure, and they have these processional groups, and they have a little bit different vocabulary and syntax. However, never, no fire ever indicated on these structures at all. These scenes do show action in this processional type of quality. The figures hold objects, vessels, or they lead animals. These scenes rarely, very rarely, have any kind of high ideological achievemented context, that is, you know, these court gowns and that sort of thing, nor are they ever rendered in the court style. So here again, I say, as we move from syntax and vocabulary to semantics, these scenes again, I think, have a very high narrative quality, but we can allow, I think, a little bit for an emblematic quality to them as well. The last category I save, because it's the most, in many ways, remarkable, because these are scenes that show both the step structure and the tower structure together in the same scene. This is Seal 66, a remarkable processional scene. Step structure, blazing fire, tower structure, attendant, and then a third, so at least three, so a processional scene. This figure holds a vessel. This one has his hand raised up to his mouth. This is 91. These were published in Pierre's recent compilation of articles about recent research on the archive. Just a beautiful scene, procession. Four attendants. Look at this detailed vessel that this one carries here. Their other hands up at their mouths. These two hold vessels that are exactly the same. This, I think, is the stand probably for a blazing fire here, a step, and then the tower structure there. This is Seal 75, which in fact has been known, it's been published very often, and two recent publications, but no one ever says anything about it. They just publish it and say, isn't this an interesting scene? Well, yeah, it is really interesting, isn't it? Here we have again this processional quality, the attendant with a very elaborate vessel pouring a libation into the fire, another attendant leading an animal, and then the step structure. This seal, we must have over 100 impressions of this seal now. It's very commonly occurs in the uninscribed tablets, and there's never anything below this. In other words, this is what this thing just seems to kind of float in space here. And here's another one of these things that when you come across it in these boxes and you clean it off, and you just think, wow. I wasn't expecting that. Look at this remarkable design. This very large tower structure, the blazing fire represented, the attendant engaged with the fire, the tower structure, an animal, and then another attendant over here. This probably shows the same type of scene. I think this is the tip of a fire. So there's a fire structure here, a vessel, tower structure, and I don't know, it's a mess over here. This may be an animal or another attendant over there. And then this, again, this is just remarkable, isn't it? Here are two structures, attendant with vessels. This time, this attendant doesn't lead, but he actually cuts the throat of the animal. I'm not making this up. If someone had showed these scenes to me or to any of you, and they were unprovenance, you say, well, these are forgeries. If you'll allow me a bit of a digression before I try to bring this material together a little bit more, I want to just say a few words about the occurrence of animals in these scenes. And so I want to bring in all of the evidence just very briefly in this digression. We've seen these scenes where an animal is being led in. I think this probably shows the same scene, and I think also that this is an animal leg here. So all of these are these processional scenes where animals are led in. And then we've got the killing of the animal here and the butchering of the animal here. Now, I do not advocate this type of approach, but one can hardly resist the possibility of putting these together in some kind of crazy narrative story. Leading the animal in, sacrifice of the animal, butchery of the animal. Now, again, I'm not advocating this kind of reading, that is, that we put these together to make a story, but I couldn't resist for you today to actually do it. All right, let's go back then and look at the salient characteristics of these scenes that show both the tower and the step structure. Well, I mentioned to you they have a high processional quality. The fire is always indicated on the step structure, never indicated on the tower structure. These scenes show a lot of action. A person is almost always engaged with the fire in some way, pouring or poking at it. The figures hold vessels or they lead animals. These scenes never, and I stress never, contain high royal ideological content that is winged symbols, court robe, crowns, date palms, etc. And thus, these scenes, again, I think, as we move to the semantics, have a high narrative content and appear rooted in reality. So I think then that we can now classes sort of see that there are four types of scenes that we have, and each of them have, I think, real clear iconological boundaries. First, there are the scenes that, such as you see here, with the step structure alone. And here I've tried to sort of link together vocabulary and syntax leading to semantics, fire, some kind of interaction, vessels, sacrifice animal, action, narrative, reality. Then we have the scenes that show the tower structure, absence of fire, et cetera, et cetera. You can read there. Then the scenes with the tower structures that are processional in quality, absence of fire, objects leading animals. And then lastly, the scenes with the stepped and the tower structure, which have both presence and absence of fire. And then, in fact, we really just have two groups, I think. The first group would be represented by these, that is, the tower structure in processional groups, the step structure alone, and the step structure, the scenes that show the step and the tower structure. These scenes all share, then, fire, various attendants, holding things, leading animals, interaction with the fire, animal sacrifice, action, high narrative content, a sense of reality. The other group, much smaller, are represented by seals, such as seal 11, the tower structure with one or two figure groups. Note that they have, that no fire is indicated. There's often a flower or a staff that is held, lots of royal iconography. These scenes are static, emblematic, and thus unreal. And I come back, I won't burden you with it, with our discussion about the importance of how this particular scene has been constructed that we examined last week. So what is the significance then of this step structure with a burning fire? It receives libations, right? It receives meat sacrifices. Vessels or bundles, sorry, bundles are often implicated in the scene. One example, this seal 20, where we've got this mortar and pestle. Now, seal 20, I should mention to you, occurs in the treasury archive only on the uninscribed labels. So it does not occur on a tablet that can be dated. So we don't know the exact date of seal 20. Stylistically, there's nothing about it that would rule out the possibility that it dates to the time of Darius. We've seen that they're the endpoint of processions. So all of these characteristics, I think, suggest that we are dealing with an altar in the traditional sense of the word. But the critical thing is that we have a religious landscape that is exceptionally varied and multidimensional. And in that sense, these images that show the stepped altar are in step with some of the things that Walter Hinckelmann was saying in his book about this varied multidimensional landscape as represented in the textual material from Persepolis. The whole question of a cult of fire in and of itself, I think, is ambiguous at best, and in many cases clearly has nothing to do with a cult of fire. What's the significance of these tower structures? Well, we've seen one interesting aspect is that I think they sort of serve as a backdrop for the step structure in these scenes where there are both of them. It can be the focus of what we can only sort of describe as adoration or attention. Again, the things never show any fire on them. And obviously the question we have to ask is, well, why? Would we associate them with fire if they have no fire shown on them at any time? And in these scenes that where we don't have the step structure, such as this seal 19 here, we've seen that there's the heavy royal ideological connotations. Now, I get I think there's a little bit more variability in the depiction of this structure than there is the step structure, although as we've seen, there is a lot of variability with the step structure as well. And so that, I think, makes us ask the question as to whether or not what this thing is signifying, and that perhaps we have here a structure that is important in and of itself. That is, it's important not for what it carries, that is a fire, but it's important because of its own iconographic characteristics, or its own iconicity would be the way that we could describe it. So does this variability represent, are we looking at different structures here? Or are we simply looking at different ways of representing the same structure? Now, to make this question even more complicated, we have other rectangular types of structures in Persepolitan glyptic that may, in fact, have some linkages to this. There must be like a dozen now of these banquet scenes. These two figures are banqueters who sit on either side of this structure that have these horizontal and vertical lines. Here's another that may be some kind of composite structure of between the two, with a seated person holding a staff. And then here's another seated person with an animal, and here's another structure that maybe, are we looking at the same thing here? And then this is a remarkable seal here, and in some ways quite unpretentious because it's not carved in a very elaborate style of carving. The tradition for this scene is out of these so-called late Babylonian worship scene that are rendered in this cut and drilled style that show a worshiper standing before the spade of Marduk and the stylus of Nabu. But this is some kind of interesting reworking of that, isn't it? Here's the worshiper, but now we've got this religious structure, horizontal and vertical lines, and then the figure in the winged symbol. I mean, this is a combination that I have never seen before, where these three things have merged together. Now, again, this is going towards this idea of making us think differently, or trying to make us think differently about what we're dealing with here. Now, the variability, right, and is trying to think about this thing as representing a particular object, perhaps we're going about it the wrong way, and that is, perhaps this thing, in all of its forms, if in fact it's all related, is not functioning as an icon per se, and here I'm using the distinction of Pierce's semiotics, and that is an icon that is something that has a physical resemblance, where there is a physical resemblance between the sign and the signified, right? So there's this physical resemblance as a icon. But rather, maybe we're dealing with a symbol. That is, some kind of pattern, model, that it's arbitrary, and which has its significance principally from its association that it has with other signs. This is the classic kind of definition in Pierce's semiotics of what the symbol is. In other words, the symbol doesn't point to a specific thing. The symbol points to a whole myriad constellation of ideas. And again, the classic idea would be the idea of a flag. The flag points to a whole lot of other symbols. And one reads the flag, a country flag I'm talking about, in that particular way. Now, so if you want to read this as an icon. That is, an object that points to a physical resemblance to something in the real landscape. It would seem to me that we have one primary candidate for that object, and that are these famous famous towers at Nansi-Rustam and Pasargadae. And certainly, I am not the first person to make this linkage. This is a traditional, in some ways, a kind of a traditional line of thought that has occurred. When you bring in these structures, almost always commentators bring in these remarkable coins that post-date the Achaemenid period. They belong to these so-called Fradaraka rulers that post-date the Achaemenid period. And their coins show these remarkable scenes that that clearly have a lot of resemblance to the Achaemenid ones. Look at this one, with this structure here, there, and then the wing, the figure in the winged disc. Now, all that these things tell us is that the makers of these things were aware of these things. But they may be helpful in the sense that what have commentators said about those things? Well, again, that doesn't help us because there's no unanimity of agreement on what they represent. That is, what these things in the Fradaraka coinage represent. Fire temples, receptacles, tombs, coronation towers, foundation houses. You can run the gamut. So unfortunately, these things don't really help us. But they do, I think, show us that the makers of these things were acutely aware of the material that we are dealing with. Now, if we take the track that this material, in fact, is not an icon, that these objects do, that these tower altars, that these tower structures are not icons, but rather they're symbol, that opens up a wide range of meaning, obviously. And to my mind, I mean, one thing that we could potentially sort of read this material, especially in these things that serve as backdrops for the step structures, is that perhaps these things are just some kind of generalized reference to monumental architecture. That is, architecture initiated by the king as a sign of his power and legitimacy and invested with religious authority. Now, this is the east facade of the Apadana, and again, commentators have not lacked to make a connection between these battlement profiles and the distinctive battlement profile that you get on these. In fact, Crefter kind of went crazy with this stuff and put these things all over Persepolis. These are some of Crefter's reconstructions here. I particularly like this one where it's like everywhere, this battlement theme. But it's interesting. I'm not sure how accurate it is. Here we are again then back to this dichotomy that I've tried to establish between these two types of scenes. This scene, I think, is clearly the one that kind of derives from this sort of material. And indeed, I would express it as sort of these diverse traditions that are represented up here in this material. They've been co-opted and reformulated to express these complex notions of Achaemenid kingship. And in fact, I think we can see the same thing at Nansi-Rustam. And I'll end here very quickly with looking at the possible interface of this material that we've examined here with the tomb of Darius at Nansi-Rustam. This is a drawing, just so you can see a little bit better, because here's that crescent over here. It's not a particularly good drawing, but it's useful for what I want to try to do here today. Now, on one level, Nansi-Rustam would appear to conform to the scenes that we've seen with the stepped altar. That is, physically, this structure seems very similar to this structure that we have, and also this sense of directionality, I think, is a part of that. However, the scene at Nansi-Rustam does not correspond to these other kinds of scenes that we've seen with the step structure. That is, this scene is very static, whereas the scenes with the step structure are always active and processional. This is the royal figure here, but he is not at all kind of integrated or doing anything with the fire, but in fact stands away from it, unlike this individual. This one loaded up with royal iconography, stepped altar scenes, rarely show that, if at all. In fact, sort of the decorum of Nanxi-Rustam is in fact much closer related to these scenes of the tower structure with the two figures on either side of them, on all of the ways that I've articulated here. Now, as we begin to look at Nanxi-Rustam a little bit more, one can notice that there may be some reformulation that is occurring here. Remember I read that passage where Boyce talked about these six figures on the flanks here representing some kind of aspect of Zoroastrianism. They seem, in fact, related, don't they, to these attendants that we see in these types of scenes. And you remember that at Nanxi-Rustam we have these wings that come out, and there's representation on the wings, on the insides, which also show figures. Now, this isn't Darius's tomb because you can't see them very well on Darius's tomb. This is tomb 4. Here is what these attendants look like. Look, they hold their hands up over their mouths. Here is the tomb of Darius on the wing over here. And we've got three of these individuals, details of them here. So it would seem that Nanxi-Rustam has, in fact, borrowed on this particular visual tradition. Here's the other wing over here. These figures hold spears. They don't have their hands up. Now, if we place the relief at Nanxi-Rustam in its sort of religious landscape, and now this is another interesting thing, I think. Nanxi-Rustam must be one of the primary religious sites of the Achaemenid period. And it's always been a mystery to me why this site has never been explored in more detail. I mean, I think, the excavation of Nanxi-Rustam, beyond what Schmidt did with clearing the tower and doing some other work in here, I think would be a really high priority. Be that as it may, if we embed the relief in its religious landscape, stepped altar with burning fire, attendants in a processional manner, and then the tower here. In other words, the tower, this scene is adapting this scene, but the tower doesn't need to be shown because the tower is actually there at Nanxi-Rustam. Now that is, of course, and I think that is a reading that could do whether you want it to be an icon or a symbol. So, again, I think with Nanxi-Rustam, what we have here is a systematic attempt to sort of blur these iconological boundaries that seem very clear in the glyptic evidence. And I think we can then infer, and probably to no surprise, that monumental relief wants to have it both ways. It wants to have a narrative quality, so it's drawn on this narrative tradition, yet it also wants to have this strong emblematic quality. And so it has reformulated that . And clearly, these types of scenes and this type of scene are both the result of this process of reformulation that is going on at the time of Darius. This evidence that we've looked at, I think, attests to what we can call the ritual penetration of Darius's program, its attempt to engage with this religious landscape and to reformulate that religious landscape, to express ideas of legitimacy, to articulate a system of belief that underpins central authority, and to visualize and reinforce a new structure of social relations. But this is all material that we'll try to digest in the last lecture. Thank you for your attention again.